This is Invest Talk from KPP Financial, helping investors make sense of the markets one day at a time. Here's your host, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome to the August 27th, 2026 edition of Invest Talk. I'm your host, Lou Guerrero. I'll be with you over this next hour as we dissect the market today, talk about the stories that matter, and most importantly, answer your finance and investment questions. To that end, before we talk about today's market performance and those show topics that we brought to the table, let's tackle this fresh caller question now.
Can you do a quick review of Danaher Corporation, DHR? That's David Harry Railroad. Thank you.
Ticker DHR is a name that I want to say we looked at maybe a couple months ago. It is a global life sciences and diagnostic platform company. So essentially what they do is they manufacture and design medical devices for life sciences, for diagnosing, for patient monitoring. Year-to-date, it's down about 5.78%, while still being up 24% over the past 3 months. I mean, it's had a pretty solid 3 months, though. Year-to-date, it's still underperforming its industry. It's about a $151 billion market cap company, and they're about due for earnings, I guess a little bit soon, a couple months away still. You know, most recently, they had a pretty solid Q2. Revenue was up 5.5% year over year. That beat. You saw pretty strong quarters in their higher growth market, about 10% from their life sciences division. A lot of that coming from China, maybe a bit of a concern as we're starting to see a flare-up in tensions related to tariffs. But one other thing that I think is a bit of an issue that may weigh down on them in the future is their long-term debt has grown quite a bit year over year, up from $16.4 billion to $19.4, now sitting about $25.1 billion as the most after the most recent quarter. So that's up $7 billion pretty much year over year. Actually, not even year over year, only in the past 8 months. And then, you know, you got a bit of a CEO transition that started in August that rallied the stock about 6%. It's one of the reasons why it's up so much over the past 3 months. So the market in general is pretty hopeful here, right? Life sciences is at a multi-year high. They had an acquisition that is doing well. Their EPS guidance raise was pretty meaningful at their most recent report. Odie agrees with me. And their new CEO is giving a bit of a catalyst for a company that really has struggled for quite some time. I mean, relative returns have been negative relative to both the market and the industry for 4 years. It hasn't been a good, really an outperformer of any sort. So for me, you're seeing the best quarter in years. You're seeing a guidance raise. You're seeing a bit of a combination of growth here in an area that, or rather a company that has been listless for a while. I would wait to see some confirmation from the earnings in October. That's October 27th. So not too far away. Because you want to see, is this just a one-off or is this a bit of a trend? That is Danaher Corporation, ticker DHR. Thanks for the call. All right, we got a great show yesterday where we looked at an analogous story to what might be happening in the U.S. We looked at Germany's aging population and coupled that with their record social spending. So is what is happening there a preview of what is going to happen in America? We also talked about XHS, the State Street Spider S&P Healthcare Services ETF. So if you want to learn more, and I thought it was a great episode, I think you should, I encourage you to check out yesterday's episode. And to remember, the best way to never miss Invest Talk is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Now on to today, where we have yet another meaningful story. This time, we'll seek to answer the question, why is the dollar weakening? What multi-month lows mean for your purchasing power? The U.S. dollar is hovering near multi-month lows as debt concerns and geopolitical risk are really starting, or rather continuing, to unnerve investors. And that weakness is and will continue to have ripple effects across everything from import prices to international emerging market assets. So we're going to break down why the dollar is under pressure, who wins, who loses, and what a sustained dollar slide would mean for the American investor. Also got a couple more stories for you, including one on electricity prices and why, given all of this demand for electricity, they might be a source of inflation, a key driver of a story that a lot of states are not prepared for. We'll also touch on rare earth metals and rare earth metal pricing, where they fit in the supply chain. And should we have time at the end of the show, a little bit of a dive into municipal bonds. We also have some voice bank calls ready to play, including one on saving to buy a house and another on MSM, which is MSC Industrial Direct Company. There's also some questions that came in from the comment section of the Invest Talk YouTube channel, and hopefully I hear from some of you live throughout the show. Headed into a break, please remember you can call anytime and leave your questions on the Invest Talk voice bank. If you're listening via our live stream or on AM 1220 in the Bay Area, I encourage you to call now at 888-99-CHART. When we come back from this break, we'll talk about today's market activity.
There are a few things that make KPP Financial special. One of them is parallel investing. This means they invest right alongside their clients. Here's how it works. When KPP Financial makes a trade for their clients, Justin Klein makes the same trade for himself and KPP on the same day, at the same price, and same percentage. No front running, no special treatment. Learn more about parallel investing at investtalk.com.
888-99-CHART is the number if you want to get through live sometime today. But why don't we talk a little bit about what went on in the market? Because if you look at the top line, what you see is a stock market that was higher. The Dow was up 20 bips. S&P was up 72. NASDAQ was up 157. The Russell 2 was up 28 bips. And so, yes, the market did finish higher, but breadth was pretty negative. All sectors outside of tech were lower. We saw the equal weight S&P actually lag the cap weighted index by about one percentage point. And so you had these names, just really a couple pockets. You had semis, which were higher after NVIDIA earnings. You had software, which did pretty well on the back of Salesforce and CrowdStrike and other earnings that were a bit better than some people expected. But most of the market, at least sector wide, finished in the opposite direction. And I think, you know, with retail being down, restaurants being down, certainly there was a big theme with respect to consumer spending. We had treasuries a bit weaker, so yields were down about 1 to 2 basis points. Gold finished up 20 bips, silver up 2.1%, and crude oil up 1.6. And so overall, I mean, it was quiet, right? We had, as I mentioned, NVIDIA. That was a pretty well-received report. You had guidance being moved upward as well. But I can't really escape what was going on with retail. It's interesting to me. I think that is probably the most meaningful part of the price action today, because the retail reporters were pretty solid. And in spite of that, in spite of these positive releases, things still tended to, within that space and for most of the market, kind of trade in the opposite direction. Looking at the economic calendar, not much today, at least not much of great importance or surprise. I mean, you had initial jobless claims come in at 203,000. That was just a touch below consensus. You had continuing claims at 1.778 million. Again, a touch below consensus. So slightly better news than expected. But really, I think all eyes are going to be on what happens next week. You know, later today, we should get a bit of a schedule of the agenda for this Jackson Hole summit this evening. Then you're going to have annual payrolls benchmark revision and final University of Michigan consumer sentiment for August, rounding out the data tomorrow. And then a bit of a speech from Fed Chair Warsh, though, given his proclivity to not want to provide forward guidance, going to be interesting to see how much the market reads into that. All right. Let's pivot back to the InvestTalk voice bank. Or no, let's actually look at a question that was submitted via web form on our website. And it's on ticker NICE. So let me pull that up. All right, ticker NICE does not trade in the U.S. So if you want to trade it from the U.S. Actually, let's read the question first. Given your recent discussion of the SAS apocalypse, sorry, what is your opinion on NICE? Up 20% from lows, but showing a forward P around 9 and estimated growth of slightly higher than that. Low debt, apparently attempting to be a disruptor rather than disrupted, with potentially higher switching costs for customers, but with significant risk their adoption of AI as part of their integrated services isn't a smooth, isn't as smooth or successful as planned. Thank you for your daily insights. All right, let's take a look at NICE. So NICE is up about 3.95% today, though down 25.11% over the past 52 weeks. Frankly, the technicals momentum on this is really poor, even going back to the end of 2023. It is an Israeli-based enterprise software provider. So what they do is they have AI-powered cloud platforms for customer engagement, for financial crime and compliance. And so it is a SaaS company for regulated industries and enterprises globally. It is a bit of a larger small cap name, $5.875 billion market cap. Growth looks solid. I mean, 12% on an annualized basis. So most of that is backloaded. They're actually supposed to grow from about $2.9 billion last year to $3.1 billion this year. As was mentioned, their PD is pretty low, trading at 8.3 times price to forward-looking earnings, 1.6 times book. So definitely towards the back end, the lower end of their five-year trend here. Most recent report was actually a couple days ago, August 5th. Revenue was up 7.6 to 8%. That was above the high-end guidance. They had ARR from AI up 52% year over year. And so you saw this beat on revenue, you saw this beat on earnings. They're raising full year guidance, but the stock fell 7-8% after the news. So you had this like classic beat and drop move here. And it's since moved upwards a little bit. I mean, earnings day, pre-earnings, they were trading about 102, 101-ish. Now it's trading about 105. So it's still a little bit up from earnings. Now, I think sometimes you have to separate yourself from what the market is doing on a short-term basis. You had better than expected revenue. You had better than expected earnings per share. You had a guidance raise. But I mean, there's a serious concern here about margin compression, EBITDA margin with the earnings and revenue raise was only up 50 basis points. And so for costs becoming a problem, I don't know, if you're trying to get exposure to AI adoption at a really cheap valuation, this may be a good way to go about it. But I'm always a bit more focused, or rather less focused, on those top line things, those flashy headlines about revenue and earnings, and more about those flow through costs and how that is affecting a company's long-term profitability. I mean, even before this upcoming year, gross margins are down from 68% to 63%. So margins definitely heading in the wrong direction, return on equity as well. So for me, in spite of the top line growth, might be a bit cheap for a reason. Small cap, if you want to get in, size that position accordingly. All right, folks, we're headed into a break. It is our first bit of a long one. But keep in mind, our 24/7 voice bank never closes. You can leave your finance and investment questions anytime at 888-99-CHART.
Luke Guerrero is here and ready to tackle your questions.
Is it a good idea to sell your losses in a Roth IRA and just use whatever you have left to reinvest into better stocks?
Just wanted to ask you about one stock that I'm looking at, Entergy ETR.
Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Financial advice should feel personal. That is why clients of KPP Financial always have access to the advisors making the investment decisions, not some low-level salesman at a big investment bank pitching meaningless buzzwords. If you think it's about time for a more personal approach to wealth management, visit investtalk.com.
So we've covered data centers from the real estate angle, if you're listening to Tuesday's episode, Justin and I answered a question on data center REITs. We've talked about the stress on the grid that typically happens. This is a bit of a different story. This is about your electricity bill, and in all likelihood, it's about to get worse. We saw retail electricity prices rise 7% in 2025. It's part of a nearly 40% climb since 2021, the fastest stretch of electricity price growth on record. You have wholesale costs that are running at 6.1% above a year prior, which is roughly double the pace of overall inflation. And the pipeline of rate increases that hasn't even hit customers yet is staggering. I don't know if you know this. Utilities requested $31 billion in rate hikes in 2025. That's more than double what they sought in 2024. Another $9.4 billion came in in Q1 of 2026 alone. And nearly half of the 2025 requests were still unapproved as of early this year. Those increases are sitting in a regulatory pipeline that eventually is going to go straight to your pocketbook. The mechanism that I think makes this important is a question of who pays when a data center doesn't show up. Utilities commit to substations, transmission lines, sometimes entire generating plants years before a data center customer is confirmed bill. The utility spends the money, the developer files the plans, then the project sinks, it moves, it vanishes entirely, but the cost doesn't vanish. Rate design determines who absorbs it, and in most states, it's you, the residential ratepayer. Now, there's a counterweight worth mentioning here. An EPRI study found that new data centers were not the main cause of the five-year rise in electricity prices. That rise actually predates the AI boom and is more reflective of a combination of extreme weather events, the absolutely old infrastructure we have, natural gas price volatility, and also the cost of integrating renewables. Some utilities argue that large data center loads can actually spread fixed costs across more kilowatt hours, and that would lower per unit prices for everyone. And in certain regions, it's happened. It's what we're seeing a little bit of in California. But the forward-looking picture is different from the backward-looking one. If you look back, that's a world with modest data center growth. The forward-looking data reflects a world where the hyperscalers are planning to consume more electricity than some states produce. That demand, it's going to be hitting a grid that was already struggling, and the cost of accommodating it, well, that's going to land on ratepayers, whether the data center materializes or not. And so for all of us, utilities with approved rate cases and large industrial customers, they are far better positioned than those with pending cases, residential heavy customer bases. The rate hike backlog is likely to be a revenue tailwind for not just utility companies, but utility shareholders. So from an investment angle, that might be where one's focus might want to be in the utility space. But for the 130 million American households that pay the bill, certainly likely to be another line item eating into budgets that are already stretched by gas, insurance, healthcare, and groceries. Now let's swing back to the InvestTalk Voice Bank to answer a question that came in earlier.
I would like to ask you about Devon Energy, DVN. Should we invest in this company or wait a little bit longer? What would be the price if that happens? Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Devon Energy, ticker DVN, is the name that we are taking a look at. It's actually a name that we used to hold in one of our strategies a while back, probably a long while back, actually. We have not held it for quite some time. That's a $51 billion market cap company. It's primarily focused in that Permian Basin. It's an oil and gas producer, so one of those the largest growing areas within the energy space. They recently completed a all-stock merger with Coterra Energy on May 7th. So a lot of the price baked in here is now going to be based upon not just how oil prices, natural gas prices are going, because, I mean, oil's 52% of their revenue. Natural gas liquids is another 9%. But also the execution of that acquisition. There's a lot that's going well for this company. I mean, they have about $1 billion in annual synergies targeted by 27. But again, is the execution going to be there? And so when you're thinking about investing in oil and natural gas in the Permian Basin, and certainly, again, this is one of the giants of it, you have to consider how much are you willing to take on execution risk here? That being said, I mean, they did have a blowout quarter that, frankly, the market barely acknowledged. I mean, they're up 28% this year, but they're underperforming their industry by 2.1. I think if you're trying to invest in the theme itself, I tend to stray away from companies that have just gone through mergers, at least for a while, until they fully integrate. So for me, I like the idea of attacking the Permian Basin. I think there are better ways to do it. Thanks for the call. On the next Invest Talk, we'll look into this story, Trade War 2.0, Canada auto tariffs hit 50% and what it means for your wallet. We'll explain how this reshapes auto supply chains, raises car prices for American consumers, and what the broader tariff escalation signals for North American economic integration. That's tomorrow. For now, I'm Luke Guerrero, and we are ready to take your calls anytime at 888-99-CHART.
At KPP Financial, accountability means more than advice. It means we invest alongside you. Through our parallel investing approach, when we recommend an investment for clients, one or more KPP principals invest their own capital at the same time. Same day, same price, same percentage. If your portfolio moves, ours does too. That is alignment. That is transparency. That is the KPP difference. Visit investtalk.com to get your free portfolio review.
It's official. Total lifetime downloads for the Invest Talk podcast are now more than 63 million. Luke Guerrero is here now, taking your calls live. Invest Talk, 888-99-CHART.
Let's talk a little bit about the dollar, and namely the fact that, well, the dollar's been weakening quite a bit this year. I mean, you saw the dollar index fell below 99 last week for the first time since May. The Wall Street Journal dollar index dropped to 95.33. That's down 7.5% year to date. The euro hit 117. That's a 3-month high. The pound reached 1.365. It's the strongest level since May. All this to say, the dollar's been a moving, and the catalyst wasn't an economic shock or a data miss. It really was the Treasury announcing it would double its bond buyback program for longer dated securities. And think about that for a second. The government's attempt to calm the bond market spooked the currency market. Investors looked at that buyback plan, and instead of thinking, great, they're fixing the yield problem, they thought, why does the Treasury need to intervene this aggressively? How bad is the fiscal situation that we're doing this? There was actually a note from Goldman Sachs to their clients, which I thought was pretty solid. I'll read it to you verbatim here. Our skepticism is not that policymakers lack the tools to influence the long end. History shows they do, at least temporarily. Our skepticism is that today's problem appears increasingly fiscal rather than technical. What does that mean? That means the U.S. has a debt problem, and buying your own bonds is not going to fix it. U.S. debt recently topped $40 trillion. The deficit is running at 6%+ of GDP. Interest payments are the fastest growing line item in the budget. Foreign official holders have been net sellers of treasuries for months, and now the Treasury is essentially stepping in as a buyer of its own long-dated bonds, which increases dollar supply, pushes up inflation expectations, and weakens the currency. And it's not a time of crisis. And it doesn't create one in that we see an immediate effect today, but it's kind of like this slow erosion that over time, if continued, is probably going to rework the investment landscape. Because what a weaker dollar actually means for everyone, at least Americans, Well, it's the most direct channel is to import prices. About 15% of what Americans consume is imported. So if the dollar goes down in value, costs go up. Electronics, clothing, cars, food ingredients, anything sourced internationally gets more expensive at the margin. It's not dramatic overnight, but it's another inflationary force layered on top of the oil shock, on the tariffs, on the cost pressures and insurance and healthcare that we've been talking about. Gas is actually the one place where a weaker dollar has an indirect upward effect. Oil is priced in dollars. So when the dollar weakens, oil becomes cheaper for foreign buyers, which can increase global demand, supports prices. So weaker dollar, stronger oil demand, higher gas prices. Now, if you invest in companies that are international, right, these U.S. multinational companies, weaker dollar is actually good. And that's really important for investors. When Microsoft earns €1 billion in Europe and converts it back to dollars, a weaker dollar means those euros are worth more in quarterly earnings reports. Same revenue, higher reported number. Same dynamic benefits any company that works international. And if you think about the S&P 500, roughly 40% of the revenues come from outside the USA. And so that's a sustained 5-10% decline in the dollar value. You can actually add 2-4% to aggregate earnings through this currency translation alone. And that begs the question, right? If this demand is falling, if the value of the dollar is going down, are foreign investors losing confidence in U.S. debt? The answer, kind of. I mean, foreign holdings of treasuries have been declining as a share of total outstanding debt for years. This isn't a new trend. We talked about the $82 billion in foreign central bank selling during the first, worst parts of the Iran war. And now the treasury is essentially admitting that the long end of the curve needs intervention to remain orderly. I mean, none of these signals individually constitute a crisis. But if you take them all together, the risk-free premium that underpinned global demand for dollar assets since Bretton Woods started to become a little bit less risk-free. And so if confidence continues to erode, it means higher interest rates, regardless of what the Fed is doing. If foreign buyers demand more yield to compensate for perceived fiscal risk, the 10-year stays elevated even if the Fed cuts. That's the nightmare scenario for the housing market, for borrowing, your borrowing, corporate borrowing, anybody who's on variable rate loans. Now, in this type of environment, when you have a sustained dollar downward trend, what does well? Probably what you'd expect, gold, right? That's up 10 to 12% over the past month. Commodities broadly, you see the DBC index is up almost 5% in the same period. International equities, look at Vanguard's EM ETF. That's up 2.8%. U.S. large caps with heavy international revenues tend to do a bit better because those currency translation benefits we talked about. And real assets in general, real estate, infrastructure, timber, copper, they represent the tangible value independent of any single currency, typically tends to do well. And this isn't a big change, I would say, from what we've been talking about for a while now. Right, maintain international equity exposure, probably unhedged so you can capture that full currency tailwind. Own commodities, own gold, as both not just inflation hedges, but dollar hedges. Favor U.S. companies with global revenue bases over just domestic-only businesses because those costs go up. If they are importing inputs to their goods. And something we've said for quite some time, keep your bond allocation short duration. Because these fiscal dynamics that are driving the dollar lower are the same things that are keeping long-term yields elevated. That being said, it's been a slow move, right? The dollar's not collapsing. There is, at this point, still no replacement reserve currency that's waiting in the wings to swoop in. But this slow, continual slide, accelerating on each new ill-advised fiscal intervention, it's telling you something about the long-term trajectory. And you need to listen. All right, let's tackle a fresh listener question from 888-99-CHART.
Hey, InvestTalk. Just have a question about saving for a house. Currently, I have a brokerage account that has about $90,000 in it, and I have 70 of it in short-term treasuries, which is S-Gov, and then I have another 20 in VT. I wanted to keep my, obviously my money is as safe as possible. And I know the short-term treasuries are a great way to do that. But I didn't know if like all of that should be in short-term treasuries or if I should be taking a little bit of risk with it. I probably have like a 2 to 3 year time horizon. I know the housing market is going to go through a little correctional period here. Just wanted to get your opinions of what I should do in the meantime. Great. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, so let's attack this from multiple angles. So first, housing market is going to go through correction, maybe. I mean, there's early signs that we're starting to transition from a seller's market into a buyer's market. Houses are staying listed for longer. Prices are falling. Could you, in the next 2 to 3 years, move into a position where you're better off than before? Only if housing prices fall, right? You need to bring new capacity online, which takes time. But I mean, rates probably aren't going to budge much. So your only hope here is that housing supply opens up either from new homes or existing homes that come onto the market and are actually sold. But I do agree, things are starting to open up a bit. Now, the next thing you got to think about is what is your time horizon? You mentioned 2 to 3 years. We actually answered a question on Tuesday about how one might want to think about this. But the other part of it that I don't really think we talked about is how much money do you need? If you are close to your goal, then certainly you can take on less risk. If you're further away from your goal, in order to meet that goal, you might need to take on a little bit more. And that doesn't mean, hey, let's take all of my housing money and throw it in micro-cap chip names. But it does mean taking on more meaningful risk in order to raise your potential for higher returns. Here's another question that you need to answer. Do you have to buy this house in 2 to 3 years? Are you doing this as an opportune thing, or is this a necessity? If it's a necessity, then you really need that money to be available. If it's, we can push this out to 4 or 5, wait for the housing market to come back, that gives you more ability to take on a risk. So this is a deeply personal question. We actually talked, I talked with one of our clients about this today. This is something we advise on for our clients as well. So if you have a specific situation where we can really dive in deeper, I certainly encourage you to sign up for a portfolio review. Because knowing everything about your financial situation is one of the inherent requirements before giving you an answer of how much risk you should be taking in your portfolio to reach not just this goal, but any goal at all. Thanks for the call. Why don't we keep things moving and answer a question that came in earlier to our YouTube channel. If you haven't checked it out already, I encourage you to head over to YouTube, search Invest Talk with 2 T's, and check out our YouTube channel. We have YouTube-specific content. We are going to be releasing new content soon, both on YouTube and on Instagram. We took a little bit of a break on that front to really focus on the podcast, but we will be back soon there. And this question is about the Italian company Buzzi, ticker BUZ. It's listed on Borsa Italiana. Ticker BZU. Apologies. It says, you mentioned Heidelberg Materials a little while ago. Maybe. Can you please give your thoughts on the Italian company Buzzi? I've owned this before, but thinking of maybe picking it up again, it's also a cement and concrete producer like Heidelberg. Buzzi, formerly known as Buzzi Unicem, is a major Italian multinational producer of cement, ready-mix concrete, and construction aggregates. Key overview, founded 1907, headquartered in Italy, Italian stock exchange, listed on Borsa. Well, thank you for that description. It's always good and helpful when you put all those things in the question. It makes my life a little bit easier. But taking a look at this name, it was founded a long time ago, family controlled still. You still have the Buzzi family, probably Buzzi is what it is, running the board. You have operations across Italy, Central Eastern Europe, the Americas. The United States is actually its largest revenue generating market. So that's certainly something that is interesting from an Italian business. About 36% of the revenue comes from the US, 17% from Italy. Now let's talk about this within the context of the dollar. Importing things may become a bit more expensive if the dollar continues to slide. As an international company that does a lot of its revenue in the United States, a bit more difficult to justify importing these types of goods. That could hurt their largest revenue center. Certainly something that you have to keep in mind. Now, their most recent earnings were pretty solid, I would say. Solid dividend, 1.6 to 1.7, trailing 12-month earnings per share, 509 euros. Performance hasn't been great this year. They're down 21.17% year-to-date, down about 11 over the past 3 months. They've actually underperformed their industry three of the past 4 years. Revenue growth has kind of dried up a bit. Looks like they're only supposed to grow from 4.5 to 4.6 billion. You know, in a lot of ways, just given their exposure, the, you know, from a business perspective, it's effectively a leverage play on U.S. construction and infrastructure spending. Let's look at their margins, because margins really matter. Down over the past 3 years from about the low 20s to about 18.8. I don't know. You know, it's family run. That's always something that I worry about. They're down significantly over the past year. Revenue trends are not great. Near the bottom end of their valuation, maybe for a reason. Given all we talked about, the dollar, all these things, I think for now, gonna have to pass. Thanks for the call. Actually, thanks for watching. Speaking of calls, looks like we have a live call from John from St. Louis, Missouri. How can I help you, John?
Hey, Luke. I was just calling to see what you thought of the stock called Grab. It's out of Singapore. It's sort of similar to Uber. However, it's more of like they're trying to make it into like a super app sort of thing. I think they operate in a few other countries in Southeast Asia. They were competing with Uber for a while, and then Uber, because of the logistics of delivering in Southeast Asia, I guess Uber had a hard time competing, and they actually pulled out. And I think Grab, if I understand right, is kind of like the biggest provider in the area of those services, delivering food and groceries, and even getting into like lending now to their deliverers. So anyway, I was just curious about what you thought of the stock.
Sure, this is an interesting one. You know, I haven't really looked at this one before. You know, they IPO'd back in the end of 2020, had a pretty large drop off at the end of 2021. They were trading at about $16 per share. Now they're trading about $3.59. Really just been beaten down relative to their industry since IPO. Down about 28% this year, down 137 today. There's not a lot of strength from a technical perspective. They're at the bottom end of their valuation ranges here. But there's a lot of good, too. I mean, they have 18 straight quarters of EBITDA growth. They have a record amount of users. They're raising their guidance. I'm kind of interested. I really haven't had enough time to dive into this name. I wish we had more time before the break to take a look at it. One concern I have is typically companies in early stages that don't concentrate and tend to have these type of businesses tend to be good at none of them. But from a high level with these growth numbers and consistent growth, in spite of the way the chart looks, it would be an interesting play to make. Certainly, though, given its market cap, its size, where it's focused, a bit of a gamble. So if you wanted to get into it, I'd definitely size the position very small. This is InvestTalk. I'm Luke Guerrero. We have one goal here: to help you achieve your financial freedom. And our work continues after our final break.
InvestTalk. Tell your friends they can listen live, download the free podcast, or watch InvestTalk on our YouTube channel. And they can leave their finance and investment questions anytime on 888-99-CHART.
All right. So there's a date that I think matters for anybody who's invested in electronics or clean energy or aerospace defense. That's because in November, the suspension that covers parts of China's expanded export control regime on rare earth materials, it expires. And in a lot of ways, you can see what is going on in the market is front-running this move. European erbium prices up more than 50% since June. Chinese prices are up roughly 40%. Buyers are stockpiling before the November deadline, and the two-price world that's emerged, it's kind of interesting. China controls over 90% of global magnet rare earth refining. 90%. That is an absolute dominance. And in a lot of ways, it means Chinese domestic prices effectively anchor global economics, even under export restrictions. But outside China, spot market's pretty immature. Bilateral confidential contracts are the norm, real price discovery. It's really difficult for Western buyers because there's no liquid exchange in order to reference. And so you have this split market. Gallium and heavy rare earth metals like dysprosium and terbium trade in Europe at roughly 5 times Chinese domestic prices. Germanium is near 3 times. Same exact material, same chemical composition, but you have different prices depending on which side of the export control you're buying on. And so this gap is essentially the cost of not having your own refining capacity. And it's a gap that won't close until the West builds processing infrastructure that really exists nowhere at scale. And in a lot of ways, this broad critical minerals landscape, it's moving pretty fast. Look at lithium. Lithium prices more than doubled this year because, 1, storage demand. 2, constrained supply. Cobalt, up 130% after the DRC banned copper and cobalt concentrate exports in August. Tungsten, up 6 times. The IEA's 2026 Global Critical Minerals Outlook flagged each and every one of these minerals as having supply chain vulnerabilities, and we're starting to see this live. And so as we get closer to November, a lot of things going on. China announced plans for a 50% output increase at the world's largest rare earth deposit. The Congo banned more exports. The Trump administration blocked tungsten and battery waste exports. Rio Tinto, BHP, they were summoned to a critical minerals meeting in Washington. Every major player is essentially scrambling in order to secure supply here. And so for each one of us who has to understand at this point that these are some and affect some of the most dominant themes that have been driving markets for years and will continue to drive markets into the future, have to understand how important this is for defense, for clean energy, for AI, for geopolitics. Companies with processing capacity outside of China, and there are a few, these are the ones that you should be invested in as strategic alternatives. Yes, critical minerals ETFs, mining funds, they offer broad exposure, but there is a real opportunity for great benefit here. And this November deadline creates a catalyst that's already being priced, but really hasn't fully played out. If China tightens further after November, this world we have, where we essentially have 2 disparate markets, does it become a 3, 4? And this Western premium will continue to get wider. So understanding how this affects not just the miners, the suppliers, but every area of the market is critical moving forward. All right, folks, that does it for yet another episode of Invest Talk. As always, Justin, the team, and I thank you for listening and encourage you to tell your friends and family members. Well, we do this podcast and you can download it for free. So head over to iTunes, head over to Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and there we will be. While you're at it, I encourage you to head over to our YouTube channel, check out our YouTube videos, and leave us a comment, good or bad. Good or bad comment, we will look always. Lastly, I want to mention our practice at KPP of parallel investing, meaning when we make a trade for our clients, we do the same trade for ourselves, same day, same price, same percentage, zero front running, zero special treatment. We think this is a good way that we can build trust, share in the same risks, and share in the same potential for success. That sounds like something that interests you, something you want to be a part of. Learn more at investtalk.com. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
Invest Talk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing.
InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm, which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.